All right, so I would like to thank you first, Thomas, and also Hugues, for organizing this wonderful day, and I'm very honored to be part of this amazing list of speakers. And so, yeah, the title is a little bit ambitious. That's our project, or maybe a 10-year, 15-year project, I don't know, to hope building a virtual embryo that would replicate, hopefully, the development and help us to understand how an early embryo develops. So these are the objects we're interested in. And so this video, I'm going to show you our 9 different species and the first day of the development of the 9 different species, which were collected at the Woods Hole at the Marine Biology Laboratory and filmed there by students. And I wanted to show you this, to start with this video, because a little bit of lag, I'm sorry for that, to show you how much, to show several things. So the first thing we remark is the diversity of shapes, the diversity of timings as well. Some embryos develop fast, some others more slowly. Some embryos have a so-called yolk cell, some others don't, some have a cavity, etc. So among this diversity, it looks very bizarre to think that we may build a common model for all these species. But that's our goal. And I'll try to convince you that maybe it might be possible. The thing we might remark, though, which is common to all these embryos, at least at the very beginning, is the shape of cells, and I'll mostly focus on that today. So, indeed, if we look at very early embryos, so the very, very first divisions, embryos look like this. These are beautiful structures. I'm always amazed by these structures. But there are already complex structures with broken symmetries, with axes which appear, and the question, one big question in the field, is early development programmatic of a cell or a self-organized process? So I think it's a debate, and I tend to see this, the development of early embryos as a self-organized process in the sense that it's through the interaction of cells that an embryo develops. So it's really the interaction of the basic elements of the structure which leads to its development. But on the other hand, the genetic regulation is constraining the development and the shape of cells, and some embryos, as I'm going to show you, have very invariant and very reproducible way of developing. And so one thing we might want to do is to extract the exact temporal sequence of biological events which happen in these systems. So if you start from the right part of this embryo, what are the key mechanical and signaling events that led to the emergence of this specific structure and not another one? And I think one of the biggest challenges in that respect is to infer the spatial temporal couplings between signaling and mechanics. We have a roughly good idea of what is the mechanics, and I'm going to focus on that. We know many of the signaling pathways which are involved in development, Wnt, BMP, FGF, etc. But how are they coupled, and how these couplings lead indeed to the emergence of a complex structure remains a big question in field. And finally, all biological systems are multiscale. And one question we might ask is how many spatial temporal scales we need to couple to really get a good understanding. So how much details at the molecular level we need to keep to really get a good understanding of developmental embryo. And I think apart from that, there is another question, is that in biology, most of the perturbation you can do are actually at the molecular level. So I think it's important for us in models to keep some details about the molecular level to be able to interpret experiments in a proper and quantitative way. And so here I show you a different perspective, 3 embryos again, but here these are the first 100 cells of these embryos. And so this first video is a mouse embryo. It takes actually 3 days to reach the final cell you're going to see, so about 100 cells. And I like this system very much, not only because I worked on this for several years, but because at the end you have only 2 to 3 cell fates. So only 2 to 3 possible cell behavior and cell mechanics. So it's, for me, it's a relatively simple system where you have 3 possible cell types, let's say. The development of this embryo is known as regulative, meaning that each embryo will have a slightly different shape, the number of cells inside, outside will be a little bit different, etc. And this is very slow, meaning that in terms of mechanics, you have time to relax and you can make a so-called quasi-static approximation where essentially dissipation will be largely negligible. Now I show you these other embryos. I think my computer is lagging, but it will come, which is an acid embryo. So it developed now in only 4 hours to reach the same number of cells. And at 100 cells, you have already roughly 17 cell fates. So I think the one in the middle didn't work. So already the complexity is much higher to me. On the other hand, it's a very invariant system that you couldn't see, unfortunately, which means that it's coming. Which means that each embryo has from one embryo to an embryo, and even here from one species to another species of acidian embryos, you get exactly the same cell position, the same cell shapes. And on the right is maybe an even more extreme of this invariant development. And these embryos develop much faster. You could see probably that in between each division, you had little time. So here, the mechanical approximation of a quasi-static system starts to be questionable. And that's why, because of this invariance, that's why in these embryos, so Siona, for example, and Siligans, you can name each cell, give it a name, because indeed you can identify them reproducibly. And so what is interesting here is to see that the Siligans, which is a very well-studied system, is one easy system to study in biology for various reasons. In particular, the genetic perturbation is easy. But for me, I think it is one of the most difficult because it's extremely dynamic and extremely diverse in terms of possible cell fate and social behaviors. Whereas the mouse embryos, which is much harder to study experimentally, is probably much simpler to start with. So here are a list of basic ingredients which I think are necessary. It's maybe not an exhaustive list, of course, what we would need to put as sort of functions or modules for these cells to be able to reproduce their development. So an obvious one is cell division. And when I talk about cell division, I need to be able to understand how division is oriented, if there may be asymmetric divisions, and what is controlling the timing of division. And I show you, as an example, this beautiful paper of the lab of Nicolas Menk, where they could show how the orientation of division only could really reproduce the patterns of a certain number of embryos, like fish, amphibian, etc. Then cells may deform, so in particular compaction, so the increase of cell-cell contacts is something very common among embryos. Cell might enter the embryo, so internalize, that's what we studied a few years back. Cell may intercalate, etc. You have, of course, biochemical interactions, so cell communicate. So there is this recent and beautiful paper by the group of Patrick Lemaire, where they showed that the geometry of cells, in particular the size of their contact, is controlling essentially the amount of ligand that one cell receives from the other and the fate specification. You have cell polarization, etc., zygotic transcription, and regulatory networks. And as I was mentioning before, and I think Edouard will talk more about that, Edouard Hanzo, is the crosstalk between these different functions of cells. So feedback loops, the possibility to sense mechanics and to tune your mechanics depending on the fate that you take. So the goal is to try to put all of that into a single virtual embryo. It's relatively ambitious. So one idea is to see the cell as a tech and engineering approach a little bit, and to see the cell as a machine. So I took this nice picture from a recent book by Max Sheets, and somehow the way I see a cell, or I hope we can model a cell, is some sort of dynamical system which receives inputs, so some cues, which can be geometry, some ligands, some mechanical strain, or maybe even an electrical potential, and will essentially couple of that to lead to some behavior, to some function, which will be, let's divide, let's create some force, let's polarize, etc. It has also its own cloak and can have cell autonomous behaviors. And somehow what I want to put in a black box is all these gene regulatory networks, which are, of course, important and will be important to perturb the system, but might not be so important to model specifically to really understand how these different think couple and to understand self-organization as a whole. So one question I ask is, can we infer from the data we have a sort of system-level regulatory network And so one way would be to see the embryo as a graph of interaction between cells, and each of these cells is some sort of microprocessor, and we will try to train these microprocessors based on available data, in particular imaging. So now I'm going to show you a bit the building blocks we've been working on. So I love Lego, so I found this this nice picture where you could see there are different parts. You can build each part independently, and then you try to put it all together to form a system that has multiple function. And I cited, so this is my quote. Everybody has given a quote today, taken from the famous Darcy Thompson, who said that the morphologist is ipso facto a student of physical science. So as soon, I think, as you study morphology, you have to study math, you have to study physics, and so this is what we do. And he was one of the first to make analogies and to say that there is a continuum in biology. It's not it's important to classify things, but biology is some sort of continuum. And in particular, he was interested in what shapes cells, and he made this analogy between embryos, tissues, and forms. And this is essentially the analogy I'm going to do today. And so there are two things you can say in terms of mechanics if you do this analogy. The first one is that if a cell is like a bubble, then it has a surface tension, which is an energy per unit surface, which will tend to minimize its surface. And so the law associated to it is a so-called Laplace's law, which relates the difference of pressure between inside and outside, the tension, and the radius of curvature. If you put two cells or two bubbles together, then you have a second law of mechanics, which is a Young-Dupré, which just tells you that at junctions, the tensions have to balance each other. And from that, you'll see we'll get a lot of things. So here are just a very rapid overview of the things we do, a little bit more complicated. So we can. I also love triangles, like Rob Phillips, and so we do some finite element modeling of cell deformations. I hope it's coming, sorry. For example, of an osmotic shock and a relaxation of the actomyosin cortex or cell division. I'm sorry, I have some issues with my. So we try to put all of that into a multicellular level to try to understand really how that couples, for example, with the shell. If you remove the shell of this C. elegans embryo, you see that the shape is very different. And we try to understand how what controls the volume, what controls the transport of ions and water through these cells. And I'm going to show you that a little bit later. On the other hand, you need to be able to compare your model with data. And I think this is very important, and we don't do that enough in a very specific or very, it's an extremely precise way, and we want to really try to get as close as possible to the data. So these are classical methods that one may use to measure mechanics, in particular surface tension, so micropipette aspiration and AFM cell compression. But one can also try to use a non-invasive methods, so methods which don't perturb the system per se. And so, for example, you can try to segment these embryos with meshes to extract geometrical parameters, or even assume a model and infer what would be the parameters of the model that would give the same shape, which is called mechanical inference. And a last thing we do is to try to create artificial images, first to test our models, our analysis methods, but also to train so-called neural networks or deep learning algorithm to help us analyze a lot of data. So this was a short overview, and now I want to apply a little bit what I'm going to have said to a specific problem, which is how to form the first biological cavity. So many embryos, not all, of course, have a so-called blastocoele, which is the first cavity that appears in development, and which interested us with Mathieu Leberge-Serrandou, who is the first PhD student of the lab. And the classical way it was described, which comes from a paper by Lewis Wolpert, is that cells will tend to divide in a circumferential way, such that the circumference or the diameter of the cell will increase, leading to the formation of a cavity, and then the cells will seal and the water will stay inside. So this is the classical way of seeing the formation of a cavity, and it probably is what happens in several species. But when we looked a little bit at what we could find in literature, we could find actually a large variety of different mechanisms for the formation of a blastocoele. So in Ixonopus, it's described as the secretion of vesicles and ions that will be pumped, and by osmotic imbalance will create a flow of water inside. In a mouse, this is what I'm going to spend the next minutes on, so I'm not going to detail here. And marsupials, something very original. The cells tend to adhere to a shell, which is surrounding the embryo. And then they will spread and divide along this shell until they indeed make a confluent tissue. So this, just to show you that there is, again, a large diversity of mechanism. But when you look at the physical processes involved, they're almost all the same. There is adhesion, there is cortical tension, there is the control of volume through osmotic gradients, and I think that's more or less, and cell divisions, and the partitioning of cell division. So playing with that, we hope that maybe we could indeed, with a single model, I think we could potentially cover all of these different mechanisms. So now I'm going to specifically focus on the mouse embryo, on which we've been working for several years in tight collaboration with Jean-Léon Maître, who now has his lab in Institut Curie. So we worked on the pre-implantation mouse embryo has several morphogenetic steps, three in majority. So the first one is called compaction, which happens at 8-cell stage and corresponds to an increase of the cell-cell contacts, which compacts the embryo into a ball. Then some cells need to end up inside to form what is called the inner cell mass, which will become the embryo proper. And that happens at 16-cell cells, and we described that it could happen through active internalization of cells. And what I want to focus on is the so-called cavitation, so the formation of a cavity from the 32-cell stage onward. So this was the work of Julien de Mortier, postdoc at the time, in Jean-Léon Maître's lab, and Mathieu, who is here in the room. And so here I show you a video of this cavitation, which is a maximum projection of the embryo. And the impression it will give, which was the impression people had, is that one cavity forms somewhere randomly and then grows. And this was described as the result of an osmotic gradient. Okay, why is it important to form a cavity, and what are the characteristics? The first thing is that it breaks the radial symmetry of the embryo, as you can see, and actually it will set the future dorsoventral axis. It creates an inner pressure, and this inner pressure will help actually the embryo to hatch. I'm going to show you that on the human embryo a little bit later. I think that's all. That's already good. But when Jean-Léon and Julien looked at this embryo, this is a section now inside the embryo, what they could remark is that. Is in fact, there are bubbles, some sort of cavities, small cavities, which form at each contact. Maybe I could... Sorry, don't look at this one. Look at this video again. So we'll stop at some point. You will see that all contacts are broken into a myriad of what we call macrolumens, so very small cavities. And then the question is how this macrolumen will end up into one single cavity. And how does that work? And so the physical analogy which came into my mind was relatively obvious, is that this is a coarsening process. And so this was analogous to what is the so-called Ostwald ripening process. So what is Ostwald ripening? It's the fact that small bubbles tend to empty themselves in big bubbles, or if you have an emulsion, that it will tend to coarsen into two separate phases. And this comes from, in fact, Laplace's law. This comes from surface tension. Small bubbles have a higher pressure, they have a lower radius of curvature, and as you know, things like to flow from high pressure to low pressure. And so in Ostwald ripening, this goes through diffusion. The process of transport is diffusion. And here, what we think is that this goes through flow. So this echoes to the beautiful talk of Karen Alim, but here what we believe is that essentially the small the cavities are under pressure because of surface tension, and they coarsen because of the difference of Laplace's law, which emerges from that. Okay, so this is a very simple model we built out of that. So this is like an electrical network, a little bit like it was shown earlier. And so we have to solve for the so-called Kirchhoff laws, so the conservation of mass, if you like. And you can relate the flux, which is like a current in electricity, to the difference of potential, which is here a difference of pressure, and the resistance, which is linked to the size of the tubes between these cavities. So you can run simulations on simple networks. Here's an example of it. And what we found from this simulation is a very simple signature of a coarsening process, which is the fact on the bottom left, right, is the fact that all the lumen will increase in size. The mean area of the lumen will increase until a certain point where they will all shrink to the benefit of a single lumen, which will be the final blastocele. Okay, so there is this biphasic structure, and we could indeed, by measuring the size of these cavities in the embryos, recover this biphasic signature. So then, okay, this is nice, but then we wonder, okay, but what does explain then the fact that the cavity is not inside, in the middle, but a little bit shifted inside the embryo? And then came into our mind the fact that the tension is probably not the same between the cells which are the trophic totem, so the external layer, and the cell which are inside. And we knew that because we had proved that the internalization process came from a difference of tension. And indeed, if you now play on tension, you can reverse the direction of the flow, meaning that essentially the flow will go where the pressure is the lowest, and the pressure can be lower because the tension is lower, not only because the cavity is bigger. Okay, so you can reverse the direction of this flow, and this is experimentally what Jean-Léon and Julien did with a beautiful experiment where they mixed, they made chimera, so they mixed different cells, so either wild-type and wild-type, and then the statistically the cavity forms with similar probability at the contact with blue and magenta cells. But when you mix wild-type cells and the same amount of cells which have been genetically modified to remove one copy of myosin, which is responsible for this cortical tension, then you see that the cavity will form statistically where the cells are more have less mechanical resistance, less tension, and so close to the green region. And so that proves that indeed, by biasing mechanics, we by patterning mechanics, we can bias the position of the embryo. So just to mention that these people call that the bubble, I don't remember actually how they call that, but essentially if you take two bubbles, or if you take two balloons and you connect them together, you will see the same effect of one balloon emptying it into itself. And this is a process which was seen also in other developmental process, in particular in oogenesis, so Drosophila oogenesis, with this very nice paper from the lab of Adam Martin, where you see clearly these flows, and now these flows are between cells through so-called ring canals in the gemmarium, and explain why all the germ cells will empty themselves into the future the future oocyte. And another case is this the oogenesis of in silicans in a worm, where you have something a little bit more complicated, but a similar a similar process of small cells which empty themselves into bigger cells. So now, okay, I've told you about flows and hydrostatic pressures, but in fact, these cavities appear because there is osmotic pumping. This is something I mentioned. If there is osmotic pumping, there are concentrations, and if there are concentrations, there are possibly osmotic pressures as well. I mean, there is osmotic pressure, of course, but there could be gradients of osmotic pressure as well. And in particular, you can have two cavities with two different osmotic pressure with two different concentrations. And if there is, this is the case, then this can also drive a flow toward the cavity of higher concentration. So the first question we had is, is there a competition between the two, and what is the most important, in fact, osmotic or hydrostatic pressure in driving the flow? The second thing which I ignore so far is the fact that the membrane is permeable. So in fact, the water can also escape on the way. So what has this as a consequence? And the last thing is that there is pumping, and you could see that the cavity, in fact, increases in size, and we know also this aspect. So to answer the first thing about osmotic versus hydrostatic pressures, this is a diagram which shows you the direction, so the immediate direction between two cavities, depending on the pressure asymmetry in the x-axis and the concentration asymmetry in y-axis. And the curve, the shape of the curve shows you that essentially to reverse the flow from by changing the concentration, you need to reach extremely high asymmetries. So essentially, osmotic heterogeneity will not lead to big effects. We don't expect it to lead to big effects. The second thing is permeation. So here I show you two different cases, one where there's no permeation through the membrane, and one tube where you have holes so the water can escape. And of course, if there are holes, then the pressure gradient can be lost on the way, and you can quantify that with a certain length, which I call psi v. And this psi v has been quantified, actually, and predicted by a former paper by Jacques Pro, and this is called a screening length. And we can define a screening number, which is the ratio of this length with the length of the tube. And so if the length of the tube is lower, then essentially you have the transmission of the pressure. If this is much higher, then the pressure is lost on the way. And this screening number depends, as you might guess, on the permeation of water and depends also on the resistance of hydraulic flow. What is important is to compare numbers here instead of talking. And this number is the radius of the mouse embryo and this screening length. And we see that these are essentially of the same scale. So it means essentially two cavities which are far apart in the embryo will see each other in terms of pressure. So we're fine. The model we proposed earlier is relatively good. There is no pressure screening in the embryo. But if you fuse two or three or four embryos, maybe actually you could lead to two different cavities. So now more physically speaking, if you start putting these cavities together and look at how they behave dynamically, what you observe is a so-called self-similarity or dynamic scaling. So what does that mean? That means that if you zoom out, if you wait a little bit in time and then zoom out, then essentially you see the same pattern. So it's like a fractal, but in time. And associated with these self-similar processes in physics, you generally recover a so-called dynamic scaling law or exponent law. And this is exactly what we find. If you plot the number of lumen or microcavity as function of time, you find a very precise law, which is here for a line of lumen, which will be minus t to the minus 2/5. And if you extrapolate that through mean field theory, you can expect in the embryo to find t to the minus 3/4. So we haven't yet measured that in embryo. We need to come back to the previous data and quantify this. This is not easy. But I think this is a very strong signature actually here of the coarsening process. And the last thing we did with Mathieu on this is to look if by biasing or patterning, especially the pumping, could also control the position of the cavity. And so these are theoretical graphs, but here I compare the red, which is a homogeneous pumping, and the green, where you have a pumping which is higher in some region, which is not in the middle. And so what you see is that if you have homogeneous pumping, you expect the embryo to be exactly in the middle. That's the distribution below. And if you shift the pumping, if you put more pumping somewhere, then as you might expect, this will tend to bias the position of the embryo. And this is interesting because, in fact, the only cells which are able to really pump continuously are the T cells, because they can pump ions from outside. The cells which are inside, if they pump, if they expel their ions, they will just shrink, and disappear. And this is not what we see. So this is a possible second explanation why the blastocell is between the T and ICM and not in the middle of the embryo and breaks the symmetry. So this is what I have explained you. And I think I will need to finish almost here. I had a few things to tell you about what controls the size of a cavity, but I don't think I will have the time. Maybe just to introduce the questions here. And I show you for that a human embryo. So here's a human embryo. And the human embryo, or mouse embryo, is actually surrounded by a so-called zona pellucida, which is an elastic shell. And you see that this elastic shell tends to limit the size of the cavity. It also oscillates. And that's something which has been recently explained. But there is a pressure that is created inside this embryo, clearly. And at some point, it will hatch. So creating this pressure is important to hatch. So one question, basic question is, can have a lumen or cavity have a stable volume? These cavities tend to grow and don't seem to be stable. They grow and grow and grow. can mechanics limit the size of a cavity? What is the difference between an apical and a basal lumen? So some lumen or cavities can face the apical side of cells, and some other can face the basal side of cells, and that makes a difference. And this is another why it is also important to understand what controls the size of a cavity, is because you can have cancerous cells as well, which lead to the spontaneous formation of the cavity and will invade the tissue. And with that, questions, I will switch to the end and thank all the people involved. Mostly for all the theoretical work, Mathieu Leverge-Terrandour and Jean-Léon Maître for the beautiful collaboration over the years. Thank you very much.